Hello, I'm Peter Anthony Holder. This is number 0500, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0500. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we remember soap actor and star Jed Allen, who passed away at the age of 84. Jed started his career on Broadway.
People forget that I was on Broadway in New York for 10 years. I was born in New York City, and I did five or six Broadway shows before I even came to California. That was my true love above anything else. Probably getting on soap operas, just the luck of the draw. You have family, you have the children, and job comes along, you take it, and you run with that for at the particular time. And then I got a Broadway show. This was all live television, by the way, back then in the 60s, and live soap opera. I was doing a Broadway show at the same time. So it was interesting. Life was good then and wonderful. And still, it was good my whole career, basically.
Clint Moss is a Manitoba farmer who earned the Guinness World Record for creating the world's largest snow maze. He normally makes corn mazes in the summer. So how different a task is this wintertime maze?
The major difference is with a corn maze, you basically are just designing where your pathways go because it's like a blank sheet of paper and you just drive your mower anywhere you want. Now with a snow maze, it took me, I'd say, 10 times longer to design because you effectively have to design where the walls go that kind of impact the pathway. And, oh yeah, it was a very involving process compared to the corn maze.
Stuart Nellman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nellman, and Book Banter goes undercover behind bars to find out what is really wrong with the prison system today in American prison. This is no Shawshank Redemption, and you will find out why on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0500 was, well, me, Peter Anthony Holder, the host of the Stuff File program. You see, I only do the guest slate on special occasions. The 100th show, the 200th show, the 300th show. You see where this is going, right? So I'd like to thank me for doing the guest slate, but I'd also like to thank all of you out there who helped me to reach this milestone of 500 shows. Not only would I like to thank all the listeners, I'd also like to thank those radio stations that also play the Stuff File program. I appreciate you a heck of a lot. And by the way, if anybody out there wants to do a guest slate for the Stuff File program, just drop me a line, because I'm always looking for somebody to open up the show each and every week, and that person could be you. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, how far would you go for insurance money? Bet you wouldn't go this far. In Slovenia, an unnamed 21-year-old woman and a 29-year-old relative were arrested for insurance fraud after the young woman cut off her hand in order to collect almost 400,000 euros in insurance payments. Two other relatives were released in the case. The four had recently signed up with five different insurance companies for life and injury coverage. With one of her accomplices, she intentionally amputated the hand at the wrist with a circular saw, hoping to stage it as an accident, according to police spokesman Walter Zrinski. The group left the hand behind when they went to the hospital, intending to insure a permanent disability. But doctors at the University Medical Center were able to retrieve and reattach it. The woman and her accomplice face up to 8 years in prison. Wow, nice swift work by the medical team and those who retrieve the hand in time. They should all rub it in while in front of the patient by celebrating with a jubilant round of many high fives. Yeah. As 25-year-old Clayton Lucas was being transported through East Deer Township, Pennsylvania, from a halfway house to a treatment class on the morning of March the 4th, which, by the way, is 69 days after Christmas, and that's an important point in this story, the van driver regaled him with Christmas songs. Turns out Lucas isn't a fan of holiday tunes, so he reached into the front seat and began choking the unnamed driver, who was strangled almost to the point of losing consciousness. Another driver flagged down a state trooper and alerted him about the altercation happening on the shoulder of the highway. After a struggle to get handcuffs on Lucas, the officer deposited him in the Allegheny County Jail, where he will face multiple charges. You know, while in jail, he should be forced to watch multiple versions of A Christmas Carol or Scrooge on a loop. Either that or a video of a Yule log while Christmas songs play continuously. Yeah, that would be just punishment. And speaking of anger, as a wedding party of 30 guests gathered on the beach at Oceanfront Park in Ocean Ridge, Florida, on March the 3rd, 27-year-old Jeffrey E. Alvord and his bride posed for photos before the ceremony. Now, trouble erupted instead when a 24-year-old man would not move from his spot on the beach to make way for the photos. In fact, Alvord told police the man wouldn't relocate even after being offered $50 and became very belligerent, so Alvord punched him in the nose. The victim told Ocean Ridge police a groomsman held him while Alvord punched him 3 times, and the police report noted that the victim's nose appears to be out of place, sitting more to the right of his face, and his glasses were broken. Alvord spent what would have been his wedding night in the Palm Beach County Jail and faces charges of aggravated battery and criminal mischief. He and his fiancée married the next day, shortly after his release from jail. Wow. His bride still married him. His lack of anger management didn't give her second thoughts? Perhaps his behavior wasn't a surprise to her. I think I have some concerns about this marriage. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Florida man called 911 after going to the bathroom and finding a bright green iguana swimming in his toilet. Fort Lauderdale Battalion Chief Stephen Golan said the man freaked out and didn't know what to do. He says firefighter Jeff Couris put on a sterile glove, reached into the toilet, and grabbed the iguana. He took it outside and released it into the wild. Golan says the department is the end-all and be-all when it comes to unique calls. The department tweeted pictures of the iguana, adding, "Can you imagine lifting the toilet lid and finding this?" Yeah. Talk about flushed with fright. You know, this makes the classic 60s flick Night of the Iguana a whole different movie.
One man. Three women. One night. The Night of the Iguana. Since man has known woman, there has never been such a night.
Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actor Jed Allen, who had a long and illustrious career as a daytime soap star, has died at the age of 84. Jed had been on Days of Our Lives, Santa Barbara, General Hospital, Love of Life, Secret Storm, and others. He also played Ian Ziering's father on Beverly Hills 90210 for 5 years. I had the great opportunity to talk to Jed back in February of 2005. At the time, he was promoting his book entitled Please Spell the Name Right, a memoir from a former young stud, now an old one. And he had recently taken over the role of Edward Quartermain on General Hospital. Here's a bit of that conversation now.
You've been doing daytime soaps for a long time. You've been on Days of Our Lives, Santa Barbara, Port Charles, currently on General Hospital.
That's right.
Your son on General Hospital is what, 4 years younger than you?
No, he's the same age.
He's the same age?
He looks great or I look like crap. It's one or the other. I can't be sure. But
You've taken over the role of Edward Quatermain. Was there any trepidation of taking a character that is clearly older than you are?
No, because they well, let me go back a little bit. In Santa Barbara, I took over something that was done by four actors in the first year of the show. They couldn't find the right one. So to change over, take it over, they give me the freedom to be what I want to be and do what I want to do. And since I was 10 years younger than the other guy who left the show to go to another show, his name was John Engel, the dear man and a fine actor. And when they gave it to me, they said, do what you got to do. I mean, there's a framework you got to stay within. But I changed my, it's my personality, basically. I'm not that manipulative normally, but you try to color everything you do anyway. You try to make it where it's never one-dimensional. It's always two or three or four dimensions, and you try to find different layers of things in soap opera. The more things you can put into a soap opera character, the longer you'll last. If you make everything black and white, you'll be off the show in a short time.
We've had an opportunity to talk to many soap stars on this program, and the thing I've always marveled at is it is some of the hardest work in television, in acting generally, because it's lots of dialogue, new dialogue every day.
New dialogue and it's new emotions every day. That's the toughest part, the emotions. The dialogue is secondary. That comes with that. It's a second nature, but the emotions you have to come up with on the call. I mean, you walk in and you're doing three scenes, you're doing them three times, five scenes, let's say. You're doing them three times a piece. That's all you do them. And you got to have the goods ready for them at the tip of your tongue, literally, and tip of your brain, too.
How long does it take a character, like the one you're playing now, Edward Quatermain, how long does it take for a character to become yours?
It depends how busy you are, Peter. I started the show being very busy, and they did a lot of wonderful things. It's not as busy as it was. They like to work the younger people more than they do the older people. It's the way the demographics read and what they want. So it's not as busy as it was, but I call it my own now. I pretty much made it what I feel I want it to be. I'm not saying that they'll ever forget John or even David Lewis, who was before John, started the character. So there's 35 years of acting between those two guys. Well, not quite 35, maybe 25. Mm-hmm. And I'm the set guy to do it. The show has been on a long, long time. But those guys have been on with, I think, 30 years together.
What made you put out this book at this time?
Book goes back about 4 years ago. I was doing a walk at Texas Ranger down in Dallas. And I met a lot of young kids on the show. They were just in the show, but some playing young heavy, some playing the ingenues and the young leading men. And we used to go out to dinner all the time, and I was kind of the older guy on the show. I was the bad guy, the lead heavy, the guest star on the show. And we used to talk, and I used to tell stories and jokes and things and try to, you know, just, I don't know, it made them feel good. And I was having a good time. I like being younger people like that. I think of my kids all the time. And one of the guys in particular, a young man named Colin Douglas, said, came to California 2 years later and said to me, you ought to write a book. I said, who's going to read it? I said, I'm only a soap opera person. Most people know me by that. I don't know what... I said, but you got all kinds of stories. I'm telling you, I know guys who want to write for you. I said, how would you know a writer? He says, I do. I said, in fact, I want to call him for you, let him call you. And sure enough, this guy calls me, a young man named Rusty Fisher, who's 37 years old, who I've never met. And he said, I am a fan of yours for 25 years. For 20 years, he said, 20 years. Since I was about 15 years old, I was watching soap opera with my folks. And I'm 37 now, something like that. I think, yeah. About 20, that's about right. And he said, I really want to write the story for you. Let me help you do it. We'll write it together. We'll do this, we'll do that. You dictate, I'll fix, you dictate, that kind of a thing. And then I started writing Stream of Conscious, and he started saying, you can leave it alone, don't touch it, I'll fix it, put it in the right kind of chapters and sub-chapters, let me handle that portion. And we put something together, which I think reads very well. It's quick, it's funny, it's enlightening, it's touching. It's funny. It tells a few things about people that I normally wouldn't have said if they were alive, because I don't want to hurt people. I'm not a tell-all person, but some of them deserve to be hurt, to be honest with you, and some don't. So, you stay with the good guys. Most of the people I've ever met have been wonderful performers, wonderful people to deal with. I rarely had a problem with anybody except the ones I named or put in the book and disguised the name.
A couple of months ago, there was, was it 2 months ago, maybe a month and a half ago, there was a great article on you in Soap Opera Weekly magazine, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about your private life, you talked about your personal life and the loss that you had recently.
Yeah.
And was that difficult to do, to talk about? I mean, you actors are used to hiding behind a role, and here you are talking about what's taken place in your life.
Well, it took place a couple of years back, but what happened was my wife passed away about 3 years ago, and we were married 43 years. So we had a marvelous relationship, and I loved it dearly. I still have difficulty talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did the show about the wife dying on the show, I don't know if you know this, the woman who played the other guy's wife was 91 years old. Naturally, she couldn't be my wife anyway because I'm so much younger. But the point being is that the woman passed away. She's a wonderful lady named Anna Lee.
Right.
And she passed away. And they wrote the show about the passing and it happened basically the same way that it happened with my wife in the middle of the night. And I woke up in the morning and my wife basically passed away in my arms. But the thing of it all was that week was the third anniversary of her death. The day that I shot that show was the third anniversary of her death. But I had to come out and say, my wife just died. Now, if that doesn't tear you up, I don't know. So basically, I was pretty roughed up that day. And it was.
And the writers, I understand, were not aware of that fact at the time.
I had no idea. No. Nobody knew anything until way after, at least a day or two after. We finally did the memorial service, which is the end of the week, and it was also difficult, but not nearly as much as the day that she passed away. And I tell you something, the reason Stanislavski became what he was for exactly that situation, because it was easy to remember. It was only 3 years, and it all came back to me. And it made it a very difficult day in between scenes, of course, but we got through it, and it became a very good show. And as I said, it's still tough to talk about it.
Going through your resume. I mean, you've been on television for quite a few years in long-running characters that you've played on daytime soaps, but I think a lot of people would also know that you're probably one of the hardest-working guest stars. I mean, if there's a what television show have you not been on over the years as a guest star?
Probably, I don't know, everything, I guess, through the years. People forget that I was on Broadway in New York for 10 years. I was born in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I did 5 or 6 Broadway shows before I even came to California. And that was my true love, above anything else. And probably getting on soap opera is just the luck of the draw. You have family, you have children, and a job comes along, you take it, and you run with that at the particular time. And then I got a Broadway show. This was all live television, by the way, back then in the 60s.
Right.
And live soap opera. I was doing a Broadway show at the same time. So it was interesting. Life was good then and wonderful. And it was good my whole career, basically. But you get stuck in that milieu, in that medium, and they think that's, as I say in the book, he's not nighttime, he's daytime. That's what they used to tell me until I really forced my way through the situations and got through to nighttime. But they wouldn't let me in for a long time because of the fact you're on daytime. There was a bias many years ago. That's kind of gone with the wind, thank God. But it was.
Now, you mentioned you did live soap operas. I guess that would have been, was the Secret Storm one of the ones
Secret
you did?
Secret Storm and Love of Life was live.
Right.
Yeah.
Back in New York.
Yeah, that's, I used to finish the show and call up my wife and say, how'd you like it? Can't do that anymore. I mean, you had to wait 2 weeks, you forget you're even on the air, 2 weeks later. But we used to call her right away and say, hey, honey, what'd you think? She said, oh, that was great. Well, hey, you missed something there. You said the wrong name. Those things, what terrible things happen on live television, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you call the girl your wife's name sometimes. you do those things. I remember doing that when I got married. I take the Toby to be my wife. It was wild times.
Well, now, at the time, and again, this is the days in New York, you're doing Broadway, you would do a soap in the daytime.
Soap in the daytime, they knocked me off on Wednesday so I could do the matinee of the show, and that's how my life was going. 2 or 3 days a week on the show during the day, and a matinee show in the evening, and an evening show, for the Broadway show.
Now, to me, that sounds like some of the hardest work in the world. I mean, you're in a situation where you're learning your lines for your Broadway play, and I'm sure you get that down pat because that, to a certain degree, does not change. But the dialogue you're doing each and every day and your other character changes, does it ever become a problem when you're in a situation doing a Broadway show at night and a soap in the daytime live?
It really doesn't, Peter, I swear to God.
Really?
Yeah, people think if you're an actor, you can cut it off. You cut off one thing, you pick up another. And also, if you're doing it for a while, You know the character so well, the daytime character. You also know the thing you're doing in the play very well. The only thing you do in a play is every when you have something live like that, when I say live with an immediate audience, you know what the audience reaction is. You go home and you say, why did they laugh then? Or why did they laugh then? They didn't laugh the night before. How did I get them to scream and cry that well when I didn't get them to do that the night before? You do that kind of a thing every night to run up a show. At least I did. It used to drive me crazy. That used to drive me nuts. But never doing this both shows. That wasn't a problem. It wasn't a problem at all. In fact, you thrive in that kind of work. You're never not busy. It's wonderful.
Now, what about the downtimes? Because that's one of the things that actors always concern themselves with. You're so busy, and then you're wondering if you're going to get a break. And then when you get a break, you're wondering if you're going to get busy again.
The only real downtime, to be honest with you, I ever had was after Santa Barbara closed. I thought I'd have everything in the world right on my palm. I was still a fairly young man, and I thought I'd have another show right away. And I didn't get a work job for almost 2.5 years to speak of. I mean, an episodic show, walked on, doing a guest starring thing, but I didn't have anything steady for about 2.5 years. Then I got 90210, and I played Russ Sanders in 90210 for 5 years.
Right.
That's Steve's father.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great joy. That was fun. Those kids were great.
Is there anything in your long career that you've wanted to do that you haven't had the chance to do?
Yes. I have never, believe it or not, I've done nightclubs. I've done singing. I've done singing on Broadway. I danced on Broadway. I've never done a comedy sitcom on a running basis. And I've done comedy all my life, but nobody ever knew I did. I did all on Broadway, most of it. But every time I came here, I was always the bad guy or the love interest or something like that. I could be funny. I was funny at times. On 902, I was funny at times. But overall, I can be a very funny man. And I never got the chance to do a sitcom at night, which I would love to do because I like the situation. It's 4 days rehearsal. You do 2 shows, and that's your week. And it's a lovely situation. You don't have to be up 5:30 in the morning like film you do, You get up at 10, you're there at 10 o'clock in the morning, you work till 5, you shoot your show on the weekend with a live audience, and it's wonderful. Wonderful. That's what I miss. That's my next thing that I really want to do.
When you think back to the beginning of your career and what your hopes and aspirations were when you started, have you basically had the kind of...
Not even close, if that's what you could ask me.
Really?
Not even close, no.
What did you envision your career would have been when you
started? I was going to be a movie star. That's what we all envision. Nobody says I'm going to be just a television personality or a television actor or a soap opera actor. They say, hey, I'm going for the big time. But life is dictated to you by certain situations, like children and marriage, like I mentioned before. You just can't walk away and say, hey, I got other things to do. I can't do this thing anymore. I can't support you. I don't want to do this job anymore. You can't do that. You got to stay with what you got. And it'll bring better things or it'll bring the same thing. In my situation, it brought a little of everything. So it was okay, but not what I really set out to do.
Well, the career you've had to date, and it's still going strong, not that bad. Not that bad at all. Very impressive.
I haven't got any complaints, Peter, whatsoever right now. I got to tell you. I am truly, I can't say content because I'm missing that one thing in my life, of course, but I'm getting there. I'm better, and it gets better every day.
That was actor Jed Allen, who passed away on March 9th, just 8 days after his 84th birthday. His book, if you still want to read it, is available on Amazon. It's called Please Spell the Name Right, a memoir from a former young stud, now an old one. You can go to thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0500, and you'll find the link to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book. And Stuff File program fans, you can hear the full version of this conversation by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. In the longer version, Jed goes into greater detail about his 50-year career and shares his family's reaction to his book and more. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about a Guinness World Record-breaking snow maze. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Anyway, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Exposing cheese to round-the-clock music could give it more flavor, and according to Swiss researchers, hip-hop might be better than Mozart.
We don't believe you, cause we the people are still here in the rear, yo, we don't need you. You ain't a killing off good young mood. When we get hungry, we eat the same food.
9 wheels of Emmental cheese weighing 22 pounds each were placed in separate wooden crates last September to test the impact of music on flavor and aroma. The cheese was exposed 24 hours a day to a Tribe Called Quest's hip-hop track, We Got It From Here, Mozart's Magic Flute Opera, or Led Zeppelin's rock classic Stairway to Heaven. 1 wheel was played the throbbing techno of Vril's UV, and another Yellow's dark ambient piece, Monolith.
Gentrify here, now it's not a shithole. Trendsetter, I know my shithole. And set a baby, cause I ain't so over there. All you black folks, you must go.
Sound waves at low, medium, and high frequencies were played for 3 hours while 1 wheel was left in peace. The most obvious differences were observed in strength of flavor, smell, and taste, Bern University of Arts researchers said in reporting the findings of a culinary jury which did blind tasting. The hip-hop sample topped the list of all cheese exposed to music in terms of fruitiness. It was the strongest of these in terms of smell and taste, according to Benjamin Luzoy, a Swiss TV chef and jury member. He went on to say, the differences were very clear. In terms of texture, taste, the appearance, there was really something very different. The experiment, instead of using loudspeakers, used mini transmitters to conduct the energy of the music into the cheese. All the energy is directly resonating inside the cheese, said Michael Harenberg of Bern University of the Arts. Beat Wampfler, the cheesemaker behind the project, said the cheeses were tested twice by the jury, and both times the results were more or less the same. He said the experiment would now focus on hip-hop. The idea is now to take 5 or 10 cheeses and put hip-hop on them and then compare. Gee, I wonder how they're going to market that cheese. Cheese from the hood? Ghetto cheese? M&M Emmentaler? Gangsta Gruyere? Oh, the possibilities are just endless.
All you bad folks, you must go.
Okay, there's a certain type of story that hasn't been around for too long, but already I'm tired of having to report these items with such regularity. It's stories that involve taking selfies. Now, here's the latest one. A woman who has only been identified by the name Leanne was attacked by a jaguar when she got a little too close to the predator's cage. In a case where just looking at the inky black 140-pound bundle of muscle and teeth wasn't enough, the cat's enclosure is separated from the public by a healthy safety margin and a waist-high fence. But none of this was a deterrent to Leanne, who crossed over a barrier in order to get a selfie with the animal. One of the female jaguars latched onto her arm, mangling it up pretty good before someone distracted the cat with a plastic water bottle, of all things. Leanne was transported to a local hospital where she was treated for non-life-threatening injuries. I was in the wrong for leaning over the barrier, but I do think that maybe the zoo should look into moving their fence back, Leanne was reported saying. I'm not the first, and if they don't move the fence, I'm probably not going to be the last, she added. By the way, there is no mention of how the photo turned out. Okay, listen up, you moron. You climbed over a security barrier to get to the fence. The question has to be asked, how far does society really have to go in order to protect people from their own stupidity? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Jordan, Minnesota, had an interesting post on their Facebook page. It said, "The caller certainly was not wanting to get too close, thinking, who is this deranged person standing outside in the cold, hugging a pillow? Always better to call the police." That was their post. What it referred to was a call they received, which they checked out. Officers duly went to see why the deranged person, and I'm using air quotes here, was braving the Minnesota cold with a pillow and no coat. It turned out that the mysterious figure had a pillow because it was Mike Lindell, CEO of MyPillow.com, and that it did not need a coat because it was a cardboard cutout. Sharing the police post, Lindell himself wrote, "Unreal." Yeah, thanks, Mike. Actually, it sounds like the cutout was a little too real.
For the best night's sleep in the whole wide world, visit MyPillow.com.
Is it really the best night's sleep in the whole wide world? Really? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It's official. A snow maze built near Winnipeg is the largest in the world. Clint Moss built a labyrinth of ice and snow on his cornfield in December with a view of breaking a Guinness World Record. And that's exactly what he's done. Clint joins us on the line right now from St. Adolph, Manitoba. Hi, Clint.
Hi there. How's it going out there?
Cold like it is where you are. So winter seems to continue, which I guess in this case is a good thing for you.
Absolutely. We had such a cold run in February that it was too cold to get a whole ton of visitors out, but this -5 endless spring is awesome for us.
Now, as I said, you built this snow maze. You've built it in your cornfield. You annually, through the course of the year in the summer times, do a corn maze as well. So is this the first time you've done a snow maze?
Yeah, absolutely. We had the idea, I want to say the idea showed up in August, and by October 8th, we already applied to Guinness to, you know, challenge the existing record.
So you have a bit of knowledge in making mazes. How different is it doing one out of snow as opposed to doing one out of corn?
You know, that's an interesting question, and it's a little technical, but the major difference is with a corn maze, you basically are just designing where your pathways go because it's like a blank sheet of paper. And you just drive your mower anywhere you want. Now, with the snow maze, it took me, I'd say, 10 times longer to design because you effectively have to design where the walls go that kind of impact the pathway. And, oh, yeah, it was a very involving process compared to the corn maze.
So from what I gather from what you're just saying, as with a snow maze, you actually have to build it. You're not carving a maze out of a large path of snow. You're constructing the walls for this maze.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very, very similar to us doing, you know, pouring basements, concrete walls. So we would make our forms up. They're 6.5 feet tall and they're 2 feet wide. So there's a lot of snow in them. And then we just start making the walls where they go and filling them with snow, tamping them down, and repeat and repeat and repeat.
How do you have, this is the first one you've done, so how do you know that you have enough snow to pull this off? I mean, when you start building this, are you worried about running out of the natural substance you need?
Yes, and we actually started it, and I knew that we couldn't even begin to challenge this without snow making equipment because, I mean, our goal was to get in getting that Christmas season where the kids are off school. And so I knew we had to make some. So we had a large snowmaking machine set up going. But the problem was we didn't have enough snow. So we underestimated, because when we snowblow it twice to get it further condensed, and it our big pile of snow, when you snowblow it twice, turned into a small pile of snow. And at about $8,000 a week for rental and fuel, we had to go back and put our equipment back in the river and rent generators and start making more snow because we consumed it all.
So overall, how costly of an experience, an endeavor was this?
We think we've right around that $57,000. I mean, there's a lot of costs we had to bear this year that we might not have next year. But yeah, it was atrociously expensive, especially coming off the worst October for weather that we've had in 21 seasons of the corn maze.
Well, gee, I hope this is not just for fun and this is a revenue generating experience, because that's a lot of cash to put out.
Yeah, it is. And I think the fact that we're going for the Guinness so helped the marketing in the front end. Before I even put the first wall up, I already had the media down. They were interested in the story and they followed us through the whole build. So when January hit, it was actually, we had 2 weekends of -2 and -5. And so we actually covered 90% of our costs in those first 2 weekends. Believe me, the pressure was off. I was a different character after that, for sure.
Now, I've taken a look at your website, which is cornmaze.ca. You're not just a farmer. You got a lot of things going on.
Yeah, we do. The farming pieces, of course, we're doing sweet corn and pumpkins, and we do bees now. But we have the haunted forest, which is the big anchor. It really marries up with the corn maze and the pumpkins. And so that's when we're the busiest, is October around here.
And now that you've had this experience of a snow maze, you said this is the first year you've done it. What have you learned from the experience that will help you in the future in doing this again?
Well, I think we're going to get our streamline. I want to build it for half the money because, I mean, it's too risky to not. Like, it was just too expensive of a build. But I gave ourselves grace on the first year. So we're going to get streamlined on how to build. That's for sure. And one thing I noticed is people like the artwork. We had Lyle Peters, a local person. He says, can I carve some stuff in your snow maze walls? And I go, hey, why not? Go at it. We're building, but you have fun there. And he came out with some awesome sculptures that you can see on our website and stuff. And people really enjoyed that. So we're going to do more of that next year. We're going to maybe not go just for large. We want to go for entertainment factor and having those cool carvings, interactive carvings, ones that people could climb on is what he's kind of going for next year. So that'll be fun too.
Okay, so you broke the Guinness World Record. Just how big is your maze and who did you beat?
Well, it was held in Toronto. In Thunder Bay, Ontario. It was held in Thunder Bay. They, I believe, were 1,679, and we beat them by 1,100 square meters. So we're considerably larger than theirs.
So I believe it was 2,789.11 square meters, correct?
That's the final number. You bet it is.
And now that you have the record, you know, heavy is the head that wears the crown. Are you worried? are you worried about someone trying to knock you off in short order some other place in the world?
Well, my first fingers were crossed that we would get through this month of February and no one would be bigger than me. Because I thought at least if we carry it for a week, we at least could tell our customers that showed up. We were, for a millisecond, the biggest in the world. But now, as we're into March, I don't think there's a winter place that can derail us this season. And absolutely, we're going to be watching that Guinness World Book of website like it's like an addiction. We're going to keep checking to make sure that we're not beat.
Actually, there's not a winter place in our hemisphere. You got to worry about that, too.
That's right. Yeah, I have to maybe go to South America, deep into the Andes. I don't know.
Now, what are your plans for next year? Do you plan to make it even bigger than it is this year?
Yeah, we're going to go bigger. I think some of it is actually just pure entertainment value. Like, people are saying, I mean, albeit it's the world's largest, my customers have come here and expect to walk for 40 minutes. You know, so right now they're walking for about 30 minutes. So I feel they're used to a 40-minute walk and then get hot chocolate or then do something else. So we're going 10 minutes bigger. And I'm not sure how that's going to relate to size, but we're going 10 minutes bigger.
And now that you have the record, how was the attention?
It's been spectacular. I know that when we were building it and we said we were doing the Guinness World Book record size, we kind of said, you know, it's a good thing we just didn't do a snow maze. You know, an average size snow maze doesn't sound nearly as interesting as the world's largest. So that has been instrumental, I think, in marketing this snow maze for sure.
Well, congratulations on your feat. You're getting attention literally worldwide thanks to the Guinness World Record. On to bigger and better things.
Yes, we've got a few cards up our sleeve to add to our property for next season. So we can't really announce those either because they're secret until you do them. And after that, I really want to talk to everyone about them.
And people can find out more information about all the things that you do on your website, correct?
Yep, you bet. Yep, cornmaze.ca.
Clint, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
All right, thanks for having us.
Clint Moss, who built a Guinness World Record size snow maze just outside of Winnipeg, Manitoba. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0500, and you'll find links to Clint's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Nearly one out of every four households includes someone who suffers from migraine headaches. Migraines can be debilitating, but fortunately, doctors have discovered that some medicines approved for ailments like high blood pressure can be very effective for treating migraines, too. This so-called off-label use of these medicines is perfectly legal. However, drug makers are banned from promoting their prescription drugs for uses other than those specifically approved by the FDA. As a result, some people with migraines and other conditions may be suffering through their symptoms unnecessarily. That may be changing, though. The courts have recently ruled that the First Amendment guarantees a drug maker's right to promote their products for off-label uses as long as the promotions are truthful. Let's be fair, we count on the FDA to protect us from misleading and fraudulent claims about our medicine. However, people suffering from migraines and other ailments shouldn't be kept in the dark about potential treatments either. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And assuming that he's made bail, here he is, Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And don't expect him to sing 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford. Sorry, I will not do that. Or Folsom Prison Blues.
Another day older and deeper in debt.
Yeah. Owe my life to the company store. That's another thing altogether. Because on this edition of Book Banter, you know, we're not going to deal with crime and punishment, but more like the punishment aspect of it, especially in prisons. Because, you know, let's start back in 1887. New York World reporter Nellie Bly did something unprecedented for a story that would deal with inhumane conditions that were prevalent through the city's insane asylums. So what she did, this young reporter, she feigned insanity so that she would be committed to an asylum located outside of New York City. And before she was released 10 days later, Bly observed and noted down the horrific conditions at the asylum as well as the cruel way the patients were being mistreated by the staff. Her articles that were based on her experiences led to increased spending and improved regulations by the city of New York to better the conditions of the city's insane asylums and create criteria regarding who should really be committed to these institutions. Now, Shane Bauer, he's a senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, has taken a page from Nellie Bly's book of How to Be an Undercover Reporter to get the inside story dealing with a pressing social matter. This time, Bauer decided to investigate how privatization of a number of prisons across the United States, especially how the prison system is being run more like a business than a penal institution. Only this time, Bauer would not see the conditions of a private prison from the point of view of a convict, but as a prison guard. Now, the series that he wrote were published in Mother Jones Magazine, and it won him a National Magazine Award. And this expose that he wrote was about what is wrong with the prison system became this riveting book called American Prison. Now, the chief culprit in this story is the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, which has over 80 types of correctional facilities across the U.S. and houses over 80,000 inmates, and operates its network of private prisons by getting lucrative contracts by different state governments and on the promise they can run these correctional facilities on a cost-saving basis. Now, somehow CCA's modus operandi is quite effective, as they raked in about $1.8 billion in revenue in 2014, the year that Bauer went undercover at this prison in Louisiana. So basically, CCA's cost-cutting measures are felt by both guards and prisoners alike. The guards are virtually hired on the spot without any background checks to speak of. The training sessions are cursory at best, and starting salaries for an entry-level correctional officer is $9 an hour compared to $12.50 an hour if you worked at a state penitentiary. And there's constant punishments for even the slightest infractions for the inmates. There's food that hardly meets any type of health standards, refusal of sending inmates with health problems to a hospital, because it means that CCA is obligated to pay the expensive cost for any medical treatment they receive. And with barely any activities or work programs to keep these inmates busy or aid them towards rehabilitation, a sense of anger and violence is quite prevalent, which led to increased stabbing incidents within the walls of this Louisiana prison. It's called Wynn. And every time Bauer recounts many of the ugly incidents of prisoner violence or abuse, he footnotes every CCA response to them, in which they categorically deny that they ever happened or that company policy was followed to the letter to ensure that such incidents were brought to their logical conclusions. And as an added bonus, Bauer fortifies his expose by offering a vast historical perspective to how the private prison system in America evolved, which goes back to before the Civil War era, where such practices as chain gangs, road gangs, and prisoner leasing were the norm. So basically, American Prison is a great piece of undercover investigative journalism, which Shane Bauer was willing to risk his own life and well-being to discover how crime and punishment has shamelessly gone corporate. And thanks to Bauer's absorbing book, we sadly discover that the world of the private prison is more like time is money rather than if you do the crime, you do the time.
And plus, though, as you just described it, those prisons are basically colleges for future criminals, because people who go in with a criminal record come out with a better criminal knowledge,
yeah,
because of the environment they've been housed in when they get out, which doesn't help society at all.
Oh, definitely not. And it's almost like, and please excuse me for saying, it's like you're getting a BA in B&E, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Breaking and entering. Very yeah. Sad.
And the BA you get there is not Bachelor of Arts. It's badass.
Yeah, sad enough. You're right. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Anyway, the book is called
American Prison by Shane Bauer. It's published by Penguin Press, and it's $37.
And dare I ask, if someone wants to read something in a similar vein, what do you recommend?
Well, I recommend if one was like to be a lifer or waiting death row in prison. This book by Carol Chessman, he was known as the Red Light Bandit. He wrote a book in the mid-50s called Cell 2455 Death Row, and I read it. It's a very absorbing book about the making of a criminal, what life is like in San Quentin prison at, you know, during the late 40s, early 50s. And this book actually got him a lengthy stay of execution because it was such a huge bestseller and had such an impact with the public. And for exposés, I recommend Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed, and basically what it's like to be a low-paying wage earner in America, where she worked at different jobs like a hotel maid, a cleaning lady, and even an employee at Walmart, to show you work hard, but you don't get the pay that's warranted for it.
Hmm. I'm just curious. You said you've read that book written by someone who was incarcerated.
Yes.
And I'm sure that's not the only one you've read under that kind of genre. How do you feel about someone who basically is in some small way, either by money or by fame, profiting from their crime by being able to write such a book?
Oh, it's a very tough ethical question, actually. I mean, Chessman, I mean, you know, he was sentenced to, you know, to death in San Quentin, and he was on death row when he wrote it. I guess he wanted to, you know, make people understand that this is, you know, how he became a criminal. This is what life is like inside death row in one of America's most notorious prisons. I don't think he expected to, you know, make a lot of money off it, but it basically, you know, extended his life on death row until he was finally, you know, put to death in 1960. He spent 12 years in death row. He was supposed to be executed in 1955, and this book basically, for lack of a better term, saved his life.
Yes, but even though he, as you say, he wasn't expecting to make a lot of money from it, even if you write a book and don't expect to get wealthy off of it, there is no one out there who writes a book and doesn't expect to get paid something for it.
Well, that's true. I mean, you remember what happened with Clifford Olson? You know, he was going to write a book and about his crimes and the murders that he committed. And he got a nice little lucrative contract, and it caused such an uproar that that was canceled. So, and Chessman actually was not a murderer. He was a bandit, and he was a robber, but he was not, a cold-blooded killer. He was just a person who just happened to commit a lot of crimes, and he did the time, and he paid the price for it. But I guess maybe he was doing it as a way to... Basically, if he couldn't get out of jail, at least maybe get his sentence commuted to life in prison.
So just let me ask you this question. On Book Banter, 3 years from now, will you be reviewing Michael Cohen's book?
Good question. It depends on, what his, the story he has to say and how he tells it and, It's a toss up. It just if the book basically, if it's not a love letter to Trump, and if he's not there to make some money. I mean, look, if he admits that, I did wrong, I supported Trump, but I did a lot of things wrong. If he's remorseful about that, that would probably convince me to read the book if such a book ever is published.
Anyway, this week's book is.
It's called. American Prison. It's by Shane Bauer. It's published by Penguin Press, and it's $37.
And how can people find you? I guess it's not behind bars.
No, and it's not in Folsom Prison. Thank you, Johnny Cash. No, it's the pages of the Montreal Times. In print every Saturday or online, www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got one more item I want to mention very quickly since we were just talking about books with Stuart Nauman. You know what it is. It's to plug my book. I got to do it. This is the 500th show. I got to plug it, right? My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still out there waiting for you, and like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and the ever-popular Much, Much More, and like the subtitle says, two guys who left their footprints on the moon. They're very impressive. Check it out. It's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca as well as at my publisher's website, which is Bear Manor Media. And it's available in all platforms. It's in hardcover, softcover, and as an e-reader, so you can get it for your Kindle or whatever e-reader you like to use. So what are you waiting for? Get the book. By the way, you can also find a link to the Amazon page on our website at thestufffile.com. Okay? Now, boys and girls, it's the moment you've all been waiting for as we end this program, as we always do, even though it's the 500th, 499 times we've done this before. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present, the idiot of the day.
A Florida man is behind bars after robbing a store disguised as Spider-Man. Deputies said a man showed up unmasked to a Winn-Dixie wine and spirit store in Castleberry, Florida on January the 2nd. He tries the doors of the closed store and leaves, but then he returns moments later, this time wearing a Spider-Man mask. Police said Edward Wilburn stole nearly $150 in liquor and $420 in Newport cigarettes. Wilburn was arrested back in January. Wilburn is a repeat offender and was recognized by the police on the video from the store, which, by the way, is now all over the internet in all its fine glory. Now, why? Oh, why? If you feel that it's important to wear a mask when you break into a closed store because you're aware that there are surveillance cameras, would you not wear the mask the first time you tried the doors just minutes before, as cameras are pointed right at the door? Well, one reason and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0500. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0500. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.